Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When Andrew Arnheimer was convicted of violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act 2 years ago, many experts were concerned about the decision's potential chilling impact on internet security and privacy. And some believe that he didn't break any laws in the first place. He's known as Weave in the hacker world. His attorneys were back in court recently to get the conviction overturned, and they do have support. With us now is Jerry Smith, tech reporter for The Huffington Post. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's go back and review exactly what Weave did and what he was convicted of.
Right. Well, this case goes back actually to 2010, and Andrew Arnheimer and an alleged co-conspirator of his basically were able to find, using a computer program that AT&T had left about 100,000 email addresses on a publicly accessible website. And what Andrew Arnheimer did was take those email addresses that he found and told a reporter about it. And a reporter at Gawker published some partially redacted list of those email addresses. And then that launched an FBI investigation into a possible privacy abuse. So it's a really interesting case. And what's happened now is Andrew Arnheimer was convicted last year, and he was sentenced to 4 years in prison for computer hacking and or conspiracy to computer hack. And he's currently serving his sentence in rural Pennsylvania in a prison there, and while his attorneys are trying to appeal his conviction.
What is the basis for their appeal?
Well, his attorneys basically say that that Andrew Arnheimer didn't commit any, that he didn't do any computer hacking, he didn't break any law, and that the email addresses that he found were publicly accessible to anyone on the internet. They're essentially saying that what he did is no different than typing in a complicated address into the a complicated URL into your address bar on your web browser. And obviously the federal government feels otherwise, and they've said that basically that this was not a freely accessible website and that he basically hacked into AT&T servers and broke the law.
My guest is Jerry Smith. He's a tech reporter for The Huffington Post. We're talking about the case of Andrew Arnheimer, convicted of violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act a few years ago. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Arnheimer was found guilty of violating, as I said, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the same law used to prosecute the late internet activist Aaron Swartz, who took his own life. How are those two cases related?
Yeah, Aaron Swartz committed suicide last January, and at the time he was facing several years in prison for illegally downloading journal articles from MIT's servers. And Aaron Swartz is a very well-known and well-liked internet activist, and his death really created a sparked outrage on the internet. And what it did is it actually led a few members of Congress to introduce legislation to amend the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And a lot of people, a lot of Swartz's supporters say that the law is just too broad, that it gives prosecutors too much discretion to file charges against people basically for what a company deems as unauthorized access, and that the term unauthorized access is vague, and it can potentially have people facing, you know, decades in prison for what might seem like a somewhat innocent violation of a company's terms of service.
Right, and possibly a reflection of a company's lack of security.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that's sort of where the Swartz case and the Arnheimer case tie in, is that, I mean, Aaron Swartz had gone into MIT's, had logged onto MIT's network and downloaded journal articles. Andrew Arnheimer and his co-conspirator were able to get thousands of email addresses of AT&T customers. And in both cases, I mean, it's, you know, you can make the argument that maybe the security for AT&T and MIT were not what they should have been.
Chet at OSU, welcome to the show, Chet.
Oh, good morning. Love the show.
Thank you.
So I've got a quick question. I'll take the answer off the air. What fundamentally is the difference between what this gentleman is being tried for and convicted of and what the NSA is doing to us on any given day and basis?
As far as invading our privacy?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks. Jerry Smith, any connection there? Any parallels?
The NSA story is a huge story, and it's very complicated. Really what it comes down to is, our privacy on the internet. And a lot of people feel like what the NSA has been doing, monitoring people's emails, monitoring people's phone calls, is a large invasion of their privacy. With the Andrew Arnheimer case, the federal government prosecutors have said that he invaded the privacy of hundreds of over 100,000 people when he found their email addresses. And handed it over to a reporter. There is the tie-in between those two issues there. The NSA story is certainly a lot more far-reaching and a lot of people would say much more troubling.
Who are some of the people in support of overturning this conviction, and how do they say that overturning the case, or why do they say that overturning the case could improve security?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about this case is Andrew Arnheimer. He's not the most sympathetic character. He has a history of being an internet troll and rubbing a lot of people the wrong way. But in his appeal, he's got some of the most highly respected cybersecurity computer law experts in the country. Orrin Kerr is a cyber law professor at George Washington University Law School. He has the former technologist of the Federal Trade Commission, the Mozilla Foundation, which makes the Firefox web browser. He has a lot of actually really highly respected people in the cybersecurity community. And the reason he has their support is because a lot of people feel like his case is much bigger than just him, that this gets down to what cybersecurity researchers and privacy researchers do on a daily basis. These are people, a lot of them are referred to as white hat hackers, but essentially what they do is they test and probe computer systems, phones, websites, and they look for vulnerabilities. They look for security or privacy flaws. And the reason they do that is that they'll bring those to the attention of these technology companies, and in a best-case scenario, the tech company, like a Facebook or a Google, will say, thank you for bringing this to our attention. We'll patch this up right now before a black hat hacker, someone with malicious intent, might try to exploit it and cause real harm to people.
When Arnheimer discovered the security flaw, covered that 100,000, those 100,000 emails, what are they suggesting he should have done? Should he have just notified AT&T without notifying the media? What was the point of notifying the media? Why did he do that? And what should he have done that would have been legal, supposedly?
Right. Well, a lot of the white, that's sort of where the case gets, where the Arnheimer comparison to the security researchers gets a little fuzzy, because security researchers, when they find these flaws, in most cases, they will go to the company.
They're working for someone.
Say, yeah, well, they're independent researchers.
Okay.
A lot of times, the companies will actually pay them money. It's called a bug bounty, where the security researchers are independent, but they can get hundreds or even thousands of dollars for bringing these flaws to the company's attention. But the company will say, thank you, please don't disclose this until after we fixed it, and the company fixes the security flaw. What Andrew Arnheimer did is he apparently never contacted AT&T and never never directly brought to their attention the fact that 100,000 email addresses of their customers were available on the internet. He went to a reporter first, several reporters actually. He sent emails to many different media outlets saying, essentially, look what I found. And prosecutors have said that he should have gone to AT&T first, or he should have gone to the FBI and said, you know, I found this major cybersecurity flaw. I'm concerned that someone could take advantage of this and really, you know, commit identity theft of thousands of people. But instead, he went directly to the media. And, you know, the reason for that, the prosecutors say, is that he wanted attention. He wanted to bring more attention to he and his co-conspirator had a cybersecurity firm that they were trying to perhaps drum up more business. So that's one of the things that, you know, he has a lot of support from the security community, because what he did is what he found is similar to what they do on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. But he didn't go directly to AT&T with what he found, and that's what prosecutors said he should have done.
As far as the original report that these redacted, partially redacted emails appeared in, it was Gawker, right? The Gawker reporter?
Yes.
Did they go to
yes.
AT&T and seek comment or anything like that?
You know, I'd have to look back on the article. I'm not sure exactly.
I mean, I'm just trying to think how journalists. He sounds like what you might think of as an old-fashioned whistleblower, saying there's a problem with their security system. AT&T's pretty
right.
big. The Gawker reporter took the information, reported it. And I'm going to just. Who knows if they contacted AT&T though.
I think it's worth noting that, what Arnheimer has, the reason he went to Gawker and not AT&T or the FBI mm-hmm. is that he was concerned that AT&T and the FBI might just completely ignore him. Mm-hmm. And that's why he felt the need to, he says that's why he felt the mm-hmm. need to go to a journalist. He felt like this security loophole that he found wouldn't be fixed unless it was, unless it was in the media, and that it, you know, created a lot of pressure on AT&T to fix this. So, and that is something that security researchers say that happens. Sometimes they'll find a big problem, a big security flaw, and they'll bring it to the company's attention, and then they'll get ignored. So that's the reason that he says he went to a journalist before going to the company.
Did this report by Gawker have any effect, and any of the subsequent reports have any effect on AT&T's business or the sale of the iPad 3Gs at all? That it was, I guess, discovered on anything like that?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, AT&T is a huge telecom company
right.
That makes a lot of money, and certainly, there's still lots of people who buy iPads. So, you know, it's really the consequences of what he did, bringing this to the attention of the media, the story that got written about what he found. It doesn't appear to have had a big, you know, impact mm-hmm. on AT&T's business, but you know, AT&T and the FBI said that you know this was a serious issue.
Now he or the people that believe in him or at least support him obviously have some friends in Congress. I guess they're trying to pass new legislation that would tighten the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to only allow malicious hackers to be prosecuted. Is that still pending? Is that still in play?
Yeah, that was legislation that was introduced in Congress last year.
Oh, okay.
It actually didn't really go anywhere. I've done a story about how the legislation never actually made it out of the committee. The reasons for that are probably many. There's a lot of other priorities in Congress that probably came first. This was something that right after Aaron Swartz's suicide, it got a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were very upset about this Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and how it can potentially ensnare people who aren't malicious hackers who are trying to steal, you know, money from customers or companies. But after several months after Aaron Swartz's suicide, apparently the pressure kind of eased on getting this legislation passed, and it hasn't passed. So it'll be interesting to see, what happens this year, and whether this this bill to amend the law and sort of tighten some of the vague language in it actually gets any traction.
And any sense about when to expect a decision in this appeal?
Yeah, I mean, his case is before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, and his attorneys and prosecutors spoke last week for about 15 minutes each, and the Third Circuit Court of Appeals can, you know, deliberate for as short or as long a time as they choose. So it's not clear exactly when they're going to come down with their decision.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jerry Smith, for talking about it today.
Thank you.
Jerry Smith, he's a tech reporter for the Huffington Post. Tech Tuesday will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Think art, and maybe paintings or marble sculptures and photographs come to mind. Electrical circuits, stuffed animals, and old plastic bags? Probably don't. At the Exploratorium's Tinkering Studio in San Francisco, so-called tinkerers use science and technology to create works of art. With us now to discuss technology and science in art is Karen Wilkinson, co-director of the Tinkering Studio at the Exploratorium and co-author of the book The Art of Tinkering. Meet 150-plus makers working at the intersection of art, science, and technology. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thanks, Anne. I'm happy to be here and talk tinkering and really liked the lead-in.
Thanks. Tinkering is not easy to say on live radio, I might add. So what exactly does tinkering mean?
Well, tinkering to me, I mean, it's interesting. We've given workshops with folks from around the world at the museum, and I think it means a lot of different things to different people. But to me, the thing I try to convey most is it is about play and playfulness, but we see it as a real serious endeavor, a way to learn about things in the world, art, science, and technology related.
I think a really famous sculpture out of the Exploratorium, or at least one that I saw in the book, was of the doll parts turned into a face, a humanoid type of face, and I've seen that other places. Why is that? What connection does that make for you between art and technology?
Well, for that one, so that's Freya Jobin's piece. She's actually an Australian artist. But a lot of folks use doll parts in their work. And I would say for me, the thing that particular piece does is it talks about a way of remaking and reimagining things. So to us, we see Barbie doll parts, but you step back a little and you see something that looks like a Medusa. So it's one of those, I don't know, it kind of gives you cognitive pause. It's a little bit scary, a little bit creepy, and, you know, connects to, for me anyway, from my past, because I played with those things as a kid.
Yep, I recognized the curve of the calf. So what's the difference between tinkering and hacking? How do they go together, and how are they different?
Yeah, well, I think tinkering has a lot to do with making, doing, hacking, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And I think a definite similarity is that it's driven by personal interest. It's a way of approaching things that kind of puts the control in your lap. And basically, you know, it's this idea that you can create something rather than consume something. So you start with an idea or a material, and you tinker with it, repurpose it, hack it, and get it to do what you're wanting it to do.
I interviewed a person who reuses things in her art to make practical things at the art festival last year. And she said it used to be kind of hard to get into some of the really heavily, you know, strictly juried or nice art festivals because she was seen more as a craft person than an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say that tide is changing, yeah. I think. I feel like making and tinkering is in the zeitgeist now, and it's becoming much more accepted and actually really respected for, you know, beautiful craft and handwork, yes, but also this idea that you can approach a material and give it a new meaning.
What do you do at the Tinkering Studio in San Francisco's Exploratorium?
Well, the Tinkering Studio here is an absolute blast, a pleasure to come to work every day.
I
but
bet.
The museum started in 1969 and really grew up around its machine shop, a place that the exhibits and the whole museum got made. So when we moved to our new location, the idea for the Tinkering Studio was to give visitors who came, a family that comes in on a Saturday afternoon, we want to give them a chance to construct something that's based on their idea, not necessarily what we want them to learn about circuits, for instance. But we want to give them an encounter with that phenomena. Often we try to make those things creative and expressive in nature. So I'll give you an example. I learned circuits one way in school. We do circuits several ways in the Tinkering Studio, but one way you can sit down and use conductive thread and LEDs to sew a circuit. So it's one of those, you know, there are science concepts, parallel and series circuits and just connections and switches and things that are kind of quote-unquote normal.
Uh-huh.
But you encounter them with these new materials, and even if you have a lot of experience, it's something new because of the materials. And if it's all new to you, there's a way to dive in too. Just for little ones, you know, learning how to thread a needle and kind of get the connections right so the light works is a big part of it too.
How much have the materials changed over time?
Well, Mike Eisenberg is a professor at UC in Colorado, and he talks about, you know, new technologies have always been around. And I think it's Mike who said, you know, anything to him that's new technology is something that wasn't around when you were born.
Okay.
But so I think things are changing really fast. A lot of electronic technologies that we use,
yeah,
are getting more and more accessible. But I think, you know, all sorts of things, polymer clays and glues and just what 3D printers can do is kind of amazing now. But I think we've been doing that throughout human history, kind of coming to understand a material by working with it and manipulating it. So that part, that sort of tinkering with materials, is not new. But the new kind of the things that are being discovered are lots of fun to push. And I find that kind of handing them over to artists and scientists. We bring people in residence with us in the Tinkering Studio quite
uh-huh.
a bit. And having those folks work side by side with visitors exploring these new things is pretty magical.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. I'm talking with Karen Wilkinson. She's co-director of the Tinkering Studio at the Exploratorium in San Francisco at San Francisco's Exploratorium, and she's the co-author of a new book. It's called The Art of Tinkering. Meet 150-plus makers working at the intersection of art, science, and technology. If you have a question or comment for Karen Wilkinson, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. How many of the people in the book started tinkering as a hobby and discovered the artist in themselves that way?
I would say almost everyone.
Huh,
I mean, we interviewed a lot of the folks, and there's a real mix of people who are still hobbyists and enthusiasts, and some folks make their living at it now. And we wanted that mix because we really believe with tinkering, it's a practice that you develop. We call it a tinkerer's disposition, and you've got to start somewhere.
It almost feels like a modern quilt type of approach.
Yeah, I think it is. I think you learn new techniques and kind of come up against things that aren't working and push through failure and frustration, and all of those things kind of bring you to your next tinkering endeavor a little bit more prepared.
I know that the final products aren't necessarily interactive, but how much of it does end up being interactive, something that people touch, feel, flip a switch on, that sort of thing?
I would say it's Yeah, a lot of it. I would say almost all of it is interactive, actually. The stuff that we do in the workshop, anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Now, there is a section in the book devoted to your own tinkering. Tell us about your art and what inspired you to start tinkering with plastic bags.
Well, it's funny. I go in waves with tinkering. Whoever is in residence right now, I'm exploring that idea.
Okay.
But the plastic bags really started when we had an artist in residence who was new to San Francisco and was asking all these questions about what they had heard about plastic bag bans, that we were banning them in the city.
Oh, that's right.
And I was collecting all these things and had friends collecting them from around the world and just didn't, you know, with interesting language or symbols on them. So I had these things mostly because they were bad for the environment and I didn't want to throw them away. And then it just turned into a little bit of a hoarding issue. But I heard about you could possibly fuse plastics together. So I just tried a little piece. And at the same time, I had actually taken apart my mother's old sewing machine and had put it back together and was going to teach myself how to sew. But I went to the fabric store, and all of the fabric that I wanted was really expensive.
Yeah.
So I tried fusing a sheet of this stuff, and those two things happening at the same time kind of took over and have kind of been out of control ever since.
You know, it kind of reminds me of I saw someone do art with lint.
Mm. I've seen that. Yes,
lint
yes,
art.
Yes.
And now I can't do a load of wash without, you know, pondering the potential of this particular ball of blue lint. What are some other technologies that tinkerers have used, and how do they incorporate them into their art? We've talked about electrical circuits and...
Yeah, well, I can give you, you know, all sorts of examples. Usually it's what I think kind of has driven a lot of the folks that are in the book is a tool or a material. But then sort of all the tangential connections that they have. So, for instance, cameras. Like, that's a technology that's really been changing, right? They're getting smaller and smaller, and, you know, you can get feeds. And we have artists that are doing incredible things with time-lapse. We also had Lauren Rojas, 9 years old, sending her Hello Kitty doll up into space, you know, and recording that. Justin Quinnell decided that his mouth would make a perfect pinhole camera. So put the film in his mouth, is in the tub, and takes a picture. So you see his feet and the tub and the faucet.
Wow.
So I think in every case, it's just what happens when you really explore an idea, and then ideas feeding off of each other, you end up with this wonderful array. And I've been so surprised that the more we do work out of the tinkering studio, the more people come up to me and say, hey, did you know I do this? Check this out. And people like this are really everywhere.
How did you curate the book? How did you find the artists for the book? And then I imagine have to pare them down.
Yeah, I think we had about 4 volumes worth of stuff that we really wanted to
right.
do. And our biggest idea was to highlight a wide array of folks who had worked with us. So it's people who have come in residence with us that really inspired the book. So it's kind of a collection of their work. But we wanted to get you to know those people deeply, kind of having them talk more about their process and how they got started, give you a chance to try something on your own, kind of in that genre, and then show, I mean, I said it before, like tangents that are related to that person's work. So Ken was the one who started looking at cameras, and then we have these 15 other ways that cameras are being used. That's the beauty of tinkering. You know, you get to take advantage of different perspectives that people have on the same idea.
The book is a lot of fun to look at. It's as varied as the different kinds of tinkerers in it, but people can get into tinkering or hacking right away with the cover of the book. Tell us why you did that. Tell us about how it works and why you did that.
Yeah, well, so you can imagine, I mean, I had never written a book before, so the work that went into it, you know, I actually couldn't imagine it at the very beginning.
Well, it's one thing to write a book. It's another thing to illustrate your particular book.
Yes, yes. But one of the things at the very first meeting that we had with the publisher is we said, we want you to really be able to tinker with the book. So we had a bunch of ideas that we were talking about. And this one that came up was, what about something with conductive ink? And, you know, months went by, and we were still trying to come up with some ideas. And finally, they found a printer that was willing to try this with us. And the amazing thing about the cover is you can stick a 9-volt battery directly onto the little gear-looking piece on the cover, and that black ink is conductive. So you can put an LED down on that same area, and it lights up. And I don't know why. I still I've been living with this book for a little while now. You know, it was released nationally in February, but I get so excited every time I see a light up.
Is that what you don't know is why you get excited or how it works?
No, it's mostly why I get excited. So
okay,
excited.
I was going to say, because I don't know how it works. So that. Go ahead.
Well, with that particular ink, really, there's tiny metal particles in the ink that are suspended in the medium. So it's really, you know, you could do the same thing. You could cut that same shape out with aluminum foil and get it to do the same thing.
Okay, let's try to squeeze in a quick call here. Pam from Columbus, you're on the air.
Hi there. This is a really interesting topic to me, and I just wanted to thank you, Anne, for letting me talk to your guest.
You're welcome.
I lit up when she started talking about the conductive thread, and then, Anne, when you mentioned like that this is all like a modern quilt, my brain just went, so can you sew with this in fabric? And if so, does it heat up the fabric? I'm just curious what applications of the conductive thread that you have seen, and you know, just curious to know how it can be used.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's an amazing material. The interesting thing that I found was exactly this. Like what did this, you know, why did this come about? The particular kind that we use was actually also used in fencing costumes. You know, when you go to score. I mean, I'm saying this like I know what fencing is.
Like when you're going to go poke somebody.
Yes, exactly. And a light lights up. Sometimes a click gets made. And that is a circuit being completed. So this incredible material, yes, you can stick it in a bobbin and sew with it on a machine. You can hand stitch with it. Some are thicker than others, and some are a little bit more conductive than others and can light up more or less LEDs. But it's incredibly fun to play with, and opens a whole new world of possibilities to thinking about kind of this mashup between craft and technology.
All right, Pam, well, thanks a lot for that question. That is an interesting thought. Karen Wilkinson, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Karen Wilkinson, she's the co-director of the Tinkering Studio at the Exploratorium and co-author of a new book. It's called The Art of Tinkering. Meet 150-plus makers working at the intersection of art, science, and technology. Tech Tuesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The use of smartphones and other wireless devices continues to grow, and with it, the amount of data streaming through the air. In order for wireless companies such as AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile to provide quality service, they need more of that radio spectrum. The FCC plans to auction off more frequencies to wireless companies next year, and the results could have major implications for the industry and for competition between carriers. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. to discuss that is Alan Holmes, a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So the FCC will auction off parts of the radio spectrum to wireless carriers next year, but they're still recreating the rules for that auction. Before we jump into that, can you explain the current status, how wireless data works now in the U.S.?
Well, right now, the two largest carriers, AT&T and Verizon, they have most of their spectrum is what's called low band spectrum. That's it gets kind of technical, but that's below 1 gigahertz. That's kind of like it's a type of frequencies that if you recall many years ago that your television station would run across. This is like in this what's called the 600 and 700 megahertz, and they use it's really nice spectrum. It's really nice frequencies. It goes long distance. It goes through buildings. If you recall when you had your rabbit ears on your television set, you had to be able to get that signal inside your house or deep inside the building. You had to go very long distance. Now, T-Mobile and Sprint, they have most of their spectrum, most of their frequencies that they use are above 1 gigahertz. And that spectrum, it doesn't go as far. You need more towers to kind of amplify that that signal across large spaces, and also it doesn't go into buildings. And T-Mobile executives have said have told me is one of their biggest complaints from customers is that when they go inside and use, let's say, a tablet or their smartphone, and they're sitting on their living room couch or something, they can't get a signal. So this is a definite competitive disadvantage to T-Mobile and Sprint, where, as people use these wireless devices more and more, sitting in their homes or in their offices, they can't get the signal, and so they're going to obviously migrate to companies that have this lower band spectrum, AT&T and Verizon, and you can see that in the number of customers they have. AT&T and Verizon have about 2/3 of the customers, the subscribers in the U.S. T-Mobile and Sprint have about 13 and 16% respectively. So that's basically where they are right today.
So the new airwaves that will be auctioned off, they're below the 1 gigahertz level?
Yes, they're in what's called the 600 megahertz band, and these are mostly television stations license this spectrum right now. And what the FCC wants to do is, and this is the first time they've ever done it, it's very complicated. No one's ever done this anywhere in the world. What they're going to do is ask TV stations to voluntarily give up those frequencies. And if they do, they will then give them a share of the proceeds that they then auction off to the wireless carriers. So there is a television broadcasters have to decide whether they want to hold on to this spectrum or not. That's the first part. And then the second part is what's called a forward auction, a typical auction that you think of is when you see an auctioneer selling, property or an estate, is that then they sell that auction off, those frequencies off to the wireless carriers. And it could be the top four, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint, as well as smaller carriers like U.S. Cellular, which is mostly around Chicago, and another company called C-Spire, and some of these smaller, but they're very, very small compared to these bigger carriers.
When the television broadcasters give up, would they be willing to give up that low band spectrum because of cable now, that everything's by cable anyways?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The cable companies were at one point looking at the spectrum. They're not quite as interested. A lot of these television stations are kind of minority owned. They're smaller stations. They don't think, FCC doesn't think like ABC will give up its spectrum in New York. There are still people getting coverage from these stations through the airwaves and not through the cable. But the whole system is there's no like if a cable doesn't necessarily have all wireline. It's as well as the wireless carriers. It's not if you're getting your internet service from AT&T or Verizon, it's not coming all over the wire. There are different parts of the network. You know, it's wireless and wired. So it's a combination of both, but really what they're looking at, probably who's going to be giving up their spectrum, and this is a concern for minority groups that represent these broadcasters, is that it's going to come from these smaller stations, these local stations that provide the type of programming that you don't get but from the major networks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and even if they do give it up, will there be enough to satisfy T-Mobile and Sprint?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question. Okay. That's what the FCC is now working on, is how do you incentivize these broadcasters to give up the spectrum? And they have to give enough up to make it worthwhile for the wireless carriers to bid on, because you need a certain amount of spectrum to build if you think of it as highways, to be able to repack it into bands that can work and carry all this tremendous amount of traffic. One thing to remember is that Cisco, in its annual report, has estimated that wireless data will surpass data traveling on your wired or cable in 2016. That's just a year and a half away, that most data will be traveling on wireless frequencies. So that's why this is so important, is that, you know, the gatekeepers, the ones that own this spectrum, or actually license it, because these frequencies are owned by the public, and so these companies really only license it. That's something to remember.
Mm-hmm.
But they are going to have a lot of power in being able to decide how they charge for that. And if you have that, it comes down to is that if you have four carriers or five carriers that can compete, some economists basically say that will keep prices down. But if two carriers can dominate this low band spectrum, some people fear that you're going to end up with a duopoly,
mm-hmm.
that prices will increase, that innovation will be reduced, and then also just being able to get what you want from your wireless device is going to be dictated by one or two companies, based on who can pay, based on content providers who can pay more. You're already seeing this with Apple and Comcast are talking about, just came out this week, they're talking about Apple having their own kind of channel within the Comcast network to deliver what they hope to be Apple TV. So it's the industry is already starting to move that way, and the wireless industry is going to be even more important about how you get your information, how you won't even see it. You won't even notice it, really, because it's done kind of behind the scenes. You won't know why you're getting slower downloads from one content provider, or even able to get certain information in certain ways. So this is why it's such a very big deal right now, and what will set the future of the wireless market.
The battle now is whether the auction will be totally open or have certain caps. Can you talk about what we mean by that, open or caps?
Sure. Yeah. An open market would be basically what you can think of as, if you see an auction going off, anybody can bid. Anybody can, let's say, you know, they're auctioning off 10 paintings. Anybody can bid on the paintings, and one person can walk away with all the 10 paintings if they have enough money and they are willing to pay that amount. That's an open auction. Now, with the FCC is considering, and the Department of Justice actually filed a document back in about a year ago with the FCC, kind of supporting this idea, is that they want to limit AT&T and Verizon from getting more of this low band spectrum. That right now, they own about 3/4 of this all available low band.
Wow.
Correct. And T-Mobile has right now just 0.2%. Sprint has none, and so that's why their networks aren't as good as AT&T and Verizon's. and why they need it to compete. So FCC is considering, okay, and there's it gets very, very complicated, very technical, but basically it would be caps that they would set based on certain formulas or these things called economic areas, certain markets. And there's a lot of very technical arguments going back and forth, but basically the bottom line is that they would try to limit how much Verizon AT&T can get in this low-band spectrum, because what they could do, the theory is that, and Verizon AT are very strongly argue against this would happen, but some economists believe it's called foreclosure. What they would do is they would buy the spectrum just so that that T-Mobile and Sprint couldn't get it.
They wouldn't use it necessarily.
They wouldn't use it, although they said that they certainly need it. They argue that that spectrum is too valuable to do that, but you know, economists say that that's a theory that could, you know, because they get a better return by being able to keep competitors out, so they can keep prices high. But that's one theory that they're arguing.
So, what kind of money are we talking about? How do they value these spectrums? Are we talking about millions, billions? What?
It's in the billions. Yeah,
really?
To give you an idea. Verizon values the spectrum that they now own around $75 billion. That's on their spreadsheet. You can go to the SEC filings. They value their spectrum at $75 billion. That's second only to all the property that they own, all the equipment that they own. And you think about all, you know, the cell towers, just how big Verizon is. It's the second most valuable asset on their balance sheet. AT&T is a little bit below that. So this is this is the lifeblood of what they do with the business, for their business.
I watch the commercials. So when Verizon especially compares itself to the other, you know, providers,
mm-hmm.
you know, they map out what their networks are. I don't know if they're accurate or not, but be that as it may, what strategically would, say, a T-Mobile be looking, shooting for? It doesn't have unlimited resources. It's that's why it's where it is anyway. What would it be shooting for? Like more of, is the lower band spectrum worth more in high density areas than it is in low density areas? Would T-Mobile be shooting for low density, lesser, you know, less expensive to start out with? How would that work?
Yeah, well, you bring up a really good point. Is that this low band spectrum can go? Remember, it can go long distances and penetrate buildings. So,
yeah.
If you think about when you're leaving, let's say, here where I live here in Washington, D.C., you know, they cover Washington, D.C., but once you go out to immediately go onto the interstates into a little more rural areas, your call can drop. You can't get a signal. So the low band, it expands your coverage area, and it's better to go over, it's easier to go through vegetation and buildings. And so, but the high band spectrum, actually, and this is what Verizon and AT&T argue, is that it can carry more data and is faster. So in urban areas, actually, that can be very advantageous. And there was,
yeah, but if it doesn't go through buildings, urban areas, that's all it is.
Well, that's a good, yeah, right. Exactly. And but what they want is a combination of these so that they can jump back and forth between the different frequencies. They can pair them in different ways. Because right now T-Mobile, if you see, advertises itself as the fastest 4G network. And the reason it's the fastest is because they have all this high band spectrum that can carry a lot of data, move faster. But then again, if you want to sit on your couch or in your office building, you might have a trouble unless you're near a window, or a doorway. that's why they need the low band spectrum.
Well, Alan Holmes, I don't know why, but I could talk about this for a long time. It's fascinating to me. It seems so seminal to what our future is with wireless.
Yeah,
I know that they're going to be voting, or the vote on the auction rules is set for May 15th. Maybe we'll catch up with you then and see what's up.
Yeah, please call back. I would be pleased to be back on.
All right. Alan Holmes, he's a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Thanks for listening today on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.